Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Zions Bancorporation second quarter earnings call. This call is being recorded. I'll now turn the time over to James Abbott. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and we welcome you to this conference call to discuss our second quarter of 2014 earnings. Our primary participants today will be Harris Simmons, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, and Doyle Arnold, Vice Chairman and Chief Financial Officer. I would like to remind you that during this call, we will be making forward-looking statements, although actual results may differ materially. We encourage you to review the disclaimer in the press release dealing with forward-looking information, which applies equally to statements made in this call. A copy of the earnings release is available at zionsbancorporation.com. We intend to limit the length of this call to 1 hour, which will include time for you to ask questions. During that section, we ask you to limit your questions to one primary and one follow-up question to enable other participants to ask questions. With that, I will now turn the time over to Harris Simmons. Harris?
Thank you, James, and we welcome you to the call today. We continue to make substantial progress on a variety of fronts, including credit quality, certain elements of fee income, generally stable net interest margin, and net interest income. We're also making solid progress on efforts that are taking place behind the scenes, including the ongoing and significant upgrade to our risk and credit management practices, which is a process that has been going on for some time now since the crisis, and an area where great progress has been made, but there's always more to do. A key challenge for Zions is holding the expense level at or near current levels at a time when the current interest rate environment has placed pressure on net interest margins across the industry, and when systems need to be replaced, and we continue to need to invest to meet increasing compliance, stress testing, and other regulatory requirements. Although all banks face the spread compression challenge, Zions is somewhat more sensitive to this pressure than some of the nation's largest banks because spread income is a larger portion of our total income statement or total revenue. Turning to the financial results for the quarter, net interest income, excluding the income from FDIC-indemnified loans, increased about $7 million or about 2%. As we have guided in the past, loan growth and reduced debt expense acted as offsets to natural pressures from loan pricing pressure and the declining source of earnings from loans purchased from the FDIC back in 2009, or so-called covered loans. With regard to loan yield pressure, the primary challenge has been new loans coming on at yields that are below those of loans that are rolling off. The competitive pricing environment has been difficult for all banks, although in many of our markets and lending types, we are experiencing some stability in marginal pricing. Regarding volume, we experienced healthy average and period-end loan growth in the second quarter, and origination volume increased slightly over the same period a year ago, up about 2%. Our managers and those involved in our small business lending are seeing improved demand and higher approval rates in their in this particular area of small business. And middle market commercial and industrial and consumer demand remains reasonably healthy. Commercial real estate lending demand in our markets is reasonably strong, although as we've discussed in this forum in the past, we are limiting our growth in commercial real estate as part of our concentration risk management practices, as well as the very high capital requirements when you consider the capital required to support such loans for those of us that are subject to Dodd-Frank Act stress tests. We're hearing from our lenders that some of the other large bank competitors in our markets are backing away from the loan type that receives the most significant losses in the stress test, in this case, the construction and land development category. So we probably are not alone in this redirection of capital allocation. Although Zions' construction and development loan balances grew in the second quarter, commitments declined. Our loan growth outlook remains unchanged on the whole, and that is for slightly to moderately increasing loan volumes. Credit quality is strong, and the trends are generally stable to improving. Our loan net charge-off ratio remains one of the best in the industry at 6 basis points total loans on an annualized basis. Non-performing assets improved by about 14% from the prior quarter and equaled 95 basis points of loans and OREO, the first time it's fallen below 1% since 2007. Classified loans declined about 5% in the quarter. With respect to capital, our GAAP common equity capital ratios increased compared to the prior quarter, with a tangible common equity ratio rising to 8.6% from 8.2% last quarter, primarily due to the cancellation of our total return swap on our collateralized debt obligation portfolio. Our Tier 1 common equity ratio under Basel I declined about 14 basis points to 10.42%, which is in line with information previously communicated to you. Finally, let me note that I suspect that many of you are anxious to know more about the Federal Reserve review of Zions stress test and capital plan resubmission. As indicated in our 8K filed on July 14th, we currently expect the Federal Reserve to provide a response to our resubmitted capital plan by July 28th. With that overview, I will now ask Doyle to review the quarterly financial performance. Doyle.
Thanks, Harris. Good afternoon, everyone. a brief overview for the second quarter of 2014. Zions posted net earnings applicable to common shareholders of $104.5 million, or 56 cents per diluted common share. This compares to net earnings applicable to common of $76.2 million in the prior quarter, or 41 cents per diluted common share. There were kind of two big swing items this between the quarters. First, recall that first quarter results included a net $31 million pre-tax gain on fixed income securities that resulted from the CDO sales that we did that quarter. That added about 10 cents per share to earnings in the that quarter, and a higher preferred dividend level that quarter reduced earnings by about 5 cents a share. The other big swing is in the second quarter due to continued strong improvement in credit quality that was referenced by Harris earlier. We had a net negative provision for the combination of funded and unfunded lending commitments of approximately $448 million negative. There's one other much smaller item that some of you will want to be aware of. We had a one-time or specific tax accrual of about $2.3 million or a penny a share this quarter related to some older tax years, which we do not expect to be included in the tax line going forward. Now I'll move on to a brief review of some of the key revenue drivers. Average loans held for investment increased $419 million compared to the prior quarter. Period end loans held for investment increased a similar amount, $432 million. The primary increases were driven by commercial industrial loans of $293 million and consumer loans, primarily residential mortgages, of $103 million. We are experiencing loan growth in July and expect it to continue based on reports from various lending groups. But as kind of indicated in Harris's opening remarks, we are constraining loan growth in some cases by self-imposed risk concentration limits, particularly on some types of commercial real estate loans. If we did not have these risk management limits, but we do, loan growth rates would be stronger because there is demand out there. In part because of the concentration limits, we are able to be more selective on the deals that we do accept. Enables us to be somewhat slower to cut pricing or to loosen underwriting standards when we encounter that kind of marketplace pressure. I'll also mention here that the increase in construction and land development loans in the second quarter was solely attributable to draws on existing lines. By design, we slightly reduced C&D commitments in the second quarter and plan to continue to at least in the near term, constrain C&D commitment growth, given the very significant equity requirement on such loans in the CCAR stress test process. We're encouraged by recent reports that the outlook for capital expenditure for both large and small businesses appears to be on the rise. The managers of our small business lending units are notably more optimistic about loan growth in that space, and in some markets, such borrowers are becoming more active. Managers of larger C&I credits report that customer optimism is about the same as it was a few months ago, and then in that area, our pipelines are generally stable with levels back in March. Managers of commercial real estate products are reporting the market remains quite robust, although there's generally less demand for new multifamily construction than in the past. Turning to new production volume, that increased approximately 2% from a year ago. We're encouraged that pricing on new loan production has remained essentially stable for the last four quarters. The yield on the loan portfolio, excluding the FDIC-supported loans, declined only 2 basis points in the second quarter to 4.28 from 4.30% in the prior quarter. The coupon on new production does remain below the weighted average coupon rate of the existing portfolio, however, therefore, we do expect additional compression for the next several quarters, although as the portfolio yield converges with the production yield, the rate of compression should moderate. Line utilization rates on revolving C&I loans were up slightly to about 33% from 32% in the prior quarter. Small C&I loans, defined as commitments less than $5 million, accounted for the increase, with a utilization rate of 40% this quarter, up from 39% in the prior quarter. Let me discuss for a moment the FDIC-supported loans and the income from that source, as I've done in the past. We continue to experience quite strong performance on the loans in this portfolio. Payoff amounts and recoveries are in excess of estimates used in previous cash flow analyses, which are updated quarterly. Such payoff and recovery activity results in accelerated income and enhanced yield of FDIC-supported and other purchase credit impaired loans. Such loans yielded an annualized 23% for the second quarter, which was very strong, but albeit down from 29% in the first quarter, or about $16 million of total interest income. That's about 3% of total interest income, yet the loans represent just 0.5% of total interest earning assets. At the beginning of this year, we expected the total remaining income from the portfolio to be roughly $80 million, the substantial majority of which would be recognized by the end of next year, that is 2015. The updated number now is approximately $100 million, of which about $39 million has been recognized in the first half of the year. Current expectation is for roughly $15 million for the remainder of 2014, between $15 and $20 million in 2015, with the remaining accretion expected to occur in years after that. However, these estimates are subject to revisions that may continue to be significant depending upon basically the underlying strength of the market for the disposition of loans that, and recoveries on loans that in that portfolio. The indemnification asset expense related to this loan book, which is recognized as a component of other non-interest expense, equaled $9 million for the quarter, down from $16 million in the prior quarter, and should amount to a total of about $6 million in the third quarter. And going into periods beyond the third quarter, if FDIC-supported loan cash flows exceed our current forecast, we will recognize additional both revenue in the form of interest income and a related expense in the other non- interest expense line. The revenue will exceed the expense, however, kind of no matter what. The amounts of both may vary. For example, if we experience $10 million of cash flow in excess of our current forecast over several quarters, we would recognize $10 million of interest income over that time frame and about $8 million of non-interest expense over the same time frame, which is the FDIC's portion of the cash flow. I wish we didn't have to talk so long about that item, but I know it's a source of noise that some of you try to back out of your estimates. So we'll now move on to the overall margin and net interest income. Turning to the net interest margin on page 13 of the release, you'll note that the NIM declined 2 basis points compared to the prior quarter. Looking at the primary drivers, reduced income from the just-discussed FDIC-supported loans reduced the NIM by about 6 basis points, and lower income from available-for-sale securities reduced it by about 3. But offsetting this, a lower balance and cost of long-term debt enhanced the NIM by about 3 basis points, and the change in the mix of the asset base, higher balance of loans and a reduced balance of cash provided about 4 basis points of NIM support. As previously mentioned, the yield on loans declined 2 basis points to 4.28% from 4.30% in the prior quarter. Yield on commercial loans was very stable compared to prior quarter, 4.28% versus 4.29% last quarter, as was the consumer portfolio, 4.07% versus 4.09%. The loan type showing the most significant compression was the construction and land development portfolio, which declined to 4.33% from 4.63% or 30 basis points. And the yields on those types of loans are fairly similar to those in the C&I portfolio at this point. On page 9, total net interest income was $416 million, which was essentially unchanged from the prior quarter, and I think in line with guidance that we've been giving you throughout the quarter. Although we ceased building a core net interest or providing a core net interest income, we have committed to giving you components so that you could continue to calculate it if you wish to do so, and we'll do so for the remainder of this year. The additional accretion on FDIC-supported loans is found on the table, bottom of page 9, equaled about $11.7 million. The discount amortization on subordinated debt was $6.5 million. Adjusting for these factors, there was about a $5 million linked quarter increase in net interest income. And the net interest margin, if one adjusted for these factors, actually increased slightly. Turning now to non-interest income on page 7, after we and many other banks experienced a very soft first quarter in fee income, ours and some others have bounced back a bit here in the second quarter. Other service charges, commissions, and fees in particular increased to $47.5 million, up from $43.5 million the prior quarter, and compared to the year-ago period is up about 3.5%. Much of the increase is due to our efforts to improve penetration of business credit cards. The fair value and non-hedge derivative income line increased by about $6 million to a negative $1.9 million from the prior quarter. This is primarily the result of the cancellation of the total return swap in late April, which we advised you of both before and at that time. We do not expect any further contra revenues from that item in future quarters. Regarding fixed income securities gains, although we did not sell any CDOs in the second quarter, we recognized a gain of $5 million. This occurs when we've taken other than temporary impairment charges in the past, or if we purchased securities at a discount to par in the past, which we did when we bought some securities out of Lockhart Funding our off-balance sheet QSPE back in the period 2007 to 2009. Anyway, if those securities now pay off at par, they're paying off at a price that's higher than the marked value. And this quarter, we received par value paydowns of $24 million, as seen on page 8 of the release, resulting in a gain of $5 million. We currently expect this to be an ongoing source of income, although it may be a bit sporadic in nature. Assuming the economy remains relatively stable, our models indicate that we should receive almost all of the par value of the performing CDOs if we held them to maturity, or about $60 million of gains. Our models also indicate that we should end up recognizing values greater than amortized cost on non-performing CDOs, but it's substantially less than the par value of those CDOs. And their realization of that income would likely take many years in the future, assuming we continue to hold them for that long. Although we may hold these securities to realize some of the gains I just described, we may also elect to sell some of them from time to time in order to maximize our capital ratios under the stress testing process. A well-defined benefit today in exchange for a less certain benefit sometime in the future. Finally, non-interest expense, turning back to page 7. Most of the line items were fairly flat compared to the prior quarter, with three exceptions. Salaries and benefits increased by $5.4 million. Seasonal expense declines for payroll taxes were offset by an expense that occurs seasonally every second quarter, which relates to stock grants to certain employees. Those, in effect, just so you understand, the stock grants for employees who are eligible for retirement and would continue to vest into retirement are expensed immediately because effectively the employee could elect to retire and have those grants fully vest over time. So that's a pop that occurs when we make those annual grants in the second quarter. Base salaries increased in part due to normal cost of living increases, but also as a result of increased staffing related to risk management, compliance, and the various systems replacement and enhancement projects that we announced a year ago. We've indicated that we're attempting to keep overall non-interest expense levels flat during this process. We expected salary levels in some professional services to increase to reflect this, offset by declines in the indemnification asset expense and other credit-related costs. Still staffing up for some of those projects, and expenditures should increase somewhat over the next six quarters and then begin to decline in 2016. I've already addressed the indemnification asset expense, which is contained in the other line. If you strip out the indemnification expense, other non-interest expense increased only slightly compared to the prior quarter. Let me wrap up now with a summary of our outlook and guidance for the next year forward or so. Loan growth, we're maintaining our slight to moderate growth outlook for loans over the one-year horizon. Although loans have continued to grow thus far in July, we don't expect third quarter growth to be quite as strong as the second quarter as we see it unfolding currently. Net interest income on a GAAP basis, including the effect of the expected decline in interest income from the FDIC-supported loans, we expect to remain relatively stable. Pressure should come from further declines in those FDIC-supported loan net interest income and as loans maturing that are replaced with loans at lower yield. As we get further out into 2014 and early 15, we expect that loan growth and higher cost senior and subordinated debt payoffs will offset much of that pressure. Excluding the FDIC-supported loan income, we expect net interest income to increase slightly over the next year. Non-interest income, we expect the less volatile components, such as service fees, to continue a modest upward trend as we push further into the mortgage space and enhance our treasury management product penetration. Turning to non-interest expense, we're attempting to hold non-interest expenses relatively stable at around $1.6 billion annually. We continue to hire for systems initiatives and regulatory and compliance-related jobs and expect our full-time equivalent employee base to increase by approximately 1% to 2% over the next year. Some of the expense of those employees will be capitalized, and somewhat offsetting the expense increases should be continued reduction in credit-related expense and FDIC indemnification asset expense amortization. Regarding the provision expense, given our expectation of continued improvement in metrics that drive our ALLL methodology, we would expect the provision expense to remain negative in the near term. Parenthetically, I'll just note that, you know, for those who are trying to figure out what to do with that line item, the first quarter's reserve release was probably a bit unusually on the low side, while the second quarter's release was probably a bit on the high side. If you're trying to, that probably somewhere in there brackets the target if you're trying to build a model. But I don't have any particular number in mind, I must hasten to add. That's just kind of the way things look. The tax rate, as I mentioned, was slightly elevated in the second quarter from that one item, and we expect it will run a bit closer to 36% for the balance of the year. And finally, preferred dividends should run around $15 to $17 million per quarter. With that, I think we'll wrap up the opening soliloquies, and operator, would you open up the lines for questions?
If you have a question, please press star then one. If you have a question, please press star then one. Our first question comes from Brad Millsaps with Sandler O'Neill. Your line is open.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi, Brad.
Doyle, just want to ask about the balance sheet. Some of the you talked a lot about, you know, the reduction in cash, but looking at the deposit base, you know, foreign deposits came down quite a bit linked quarter. Can you talk a little bit about that and some of the movement you might see in the liquidity as you look out over the back half of the year, what your plans might be there, how they may have changed?
We debated about whether to talk about deposits in the opening remarks and wait for the question, and the question is number one. There were kind of two unusual items in deposits. One is we closed a Cayman Islands branch, which reduced the foreign deposits, but they were all rebooked domestically. So if you look I believe it was mostly went into savings and now accounts, was it?
Yes.
David, savings and money market accounts. So that line item increased slightly, so that was just a shift. We did the net reduction in deposits between $800 and $900 million was driven primarily by the departure of one large institutional customer that we had. It was a college savings plan customer that we effectively no-bid the renewal because it was costing more than the deposits were worth. So, and there was no other real relationship with that party. So it was a result of a decision that we actually had plenty of liquidity, and so that was our choice to exit that account. I'll give you a chance to follow up on that one if that wasn't clear.
No, thanks. Maybe just to follow up, just in terms of the liquidity, you know, the $7.5 billion of money market on average, I guess it was down to a little more than six on a period end basis. Any change in how you're going to manage that going forward?
No, I mean, we're beginning to track against some of the new liquidity metrics that will become binding, I think, in January, particularly liquidity coverage ratio. The final rules are not yet published, as you know, but as best we can calculate it, we think we are in pretty good shape on that metric, but there's a lot less than $7.5 billion of true excess liquidity there. We will have to hold a number of billions of dollars of liquidity in the form of cash or very, very low risk, very, very liquid assets like treasuries, for example, going forward anyway. So I think the best outlook is that loan growth will continue to erode into that cash amount at an incremental rate, but there are no plans to, given the flatness and lowness of the yield curve, to move a lot of that cash out. David, anything you'd like to add on that?
No, I'd agree with that.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you, guys.
Yes.
Our next question comes from Steven Alexopoulos with JPMorgan. Your line is open.
Hello, Steve.
Regarding the stress test, Harris, in your prepared comments, you indicated larger banks directing capital away from C&D loans. Based on what you guys are seeing from the stress test and now resubmission, is there anything you'd flag for us as a change in the way you guys plan to run the business?
Well, I just underscore what both Doyle and I think said, and that is that one of the things we're certainly focused on is the capital consumed by construction and development. And so we are actively trying to manage down exposures there. Ultimately, it's a business that will always be in here in the West. It's an important line of business to us. And we may find other ways to conduct some of this business through an originate and sell kind of a model. But that, in particular, is a near-term focus. We're interested to see results, our own results and those of the Federal Reserve in the 2015 CCAR exercise. That will probably provide some additional color to us in terms of how we're going to think about this. But we do understand that commercial real estate generally is consuming more capital than some of the other loan types in the context of stress tests. And so we're trying to think about that accordingly as we establish concentration limits.
I'd just add, if you go back to the Federal Reserve's published CCAR results for all the banks, the stress losses on commercial real estate loans were pretty high compared to other types. And while the Fed does not provide a breakdown between construction, development, and term and owner-occupied, we and investment banks and consultants have all tried to estimate what that breakdown might be. And it looks like the construction development are maybe double or more the loss rates that the Fed publishes for overall CRE, which makes it pretty painful from a capital utilization standpoint relative to, as I mentioned, pricing that has actually come down over time. And so that's what we're dealing with.
Well, maybe to follow up, what's your annual spend running now tied to compliance-related costs as a CCAR bank? And are you at the stage now where it sounds like you're still building on that? We shouldn't be thinking of any room for efficiencies here, at least over the near term.
Well, I think it's this is Harris, but it's the slope of the line is leveling, I think. I mean, it's not we're not adding at the pace that we were two or three years ago. But it's and it's actually something that I
be reluctant to try to nail down an actual cost. We've added, I mean, the last time I tried to track this, we'd added something over 300 full-time equivalent staff, sort of, this goes back about a year ago, and that was over the prior couple of years. And that number's continued to grow, but not at the same pace. So
if you read some of the speeches by Federal Reserve governors, particularly Governor Tarullo lately, he indicates publicly what we're experiencing directly, which is that the Fed's level of expectation does continue to increase. And it would appear you've got another couple of years of continued heightened expectations, although we're not having to add as much staff to meet those expectations as just redeploy them into addressing the current year's level of top concerns that they're expressing to us in the industry. I don't know if that makes if you followed that, but that's we're all on. They describe it as a glide path upward to a spot they want us all to get to.
And I'd only say, I mean, heightened expectations, I think, is always going to be with us. And that's just the new environment that I think all banks find themselves in. I think the couple of years that Doyle's talking about is probably a couple more years of, some building spend. But we also, as we've talked about some of these big systems projects, we're becoming more encouraged that as we get those in place, that we'll be able to see some
offsetting savings. And
we see some silver linings on the horizon.
Okay. Thanks for all the color.
Yeah.
Our next question comes from Joe Morford with RBC Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
I guess I was just curious if you could give us any color on regional trends in loan growth this quarter.
You want to talk about that, James?
Hi, Joe. It's James here. I would say we saw really strong, the strongest growth came from the Amegy and the Utah banks. Utah had a very strong C&I growth in the quarter. On the small business front in Utah, there's a lot of optimism today. Just really a good overall market. I believe the unemployment rate in Utah is 3.6.
3.5.
But who's counting? And so it's been very strong on those fronts. We saw very good consumer loan growth across most of the franchise. So it really is pretty a broad-based growth. And I would just say that probably the areas that we did experience some attrition is on obviously on term commercial real estate, and some of that was it was across some of the several places in the footprint. Did experience growth in construction and land development across about four or five of the affiliate banks, but the commitments have come down in virtually all of the affiliate banks compared to the prior quarter.
Okay, that's helpful. I guess the other question was just a couple things on expenses. I recognize some of these line items bounce around, but the provision for unfunded commitments was up from last quarter, which is a slight recovery, though the overall level of commitment seemed like it was stable. So wondered what was going on there, maybe something unusual last quarter. And then similarly with the elevated provisional and legal services, now that we're through the resubmission, do you think we'll start to see that level start to tail down a little bit?
We'll take them in order. The provision for unfunded lending commitments is moved around by a number of things. There were actually some very late quarter increases in right at the end of the quarter increases in commitments last quarter that weren't picked up in our methodology. They were not deemed material, but that added, it did add to the provision for unfunded commitments this quarter. We had a little bit of deterioration in one credit quality metric that in a couple of loans, but there's no, you know, I think the best thing I could tell you there is that the overall in this environment, the growth in the provision for unfunded commitments ought to be somewhere around zero to a very small positive number, with the driver being growth in new commitments or unfunded commitments driving the number to be positive, and continued improvements, general improvements in credit quality, pushing it back down towards zero. On consulting and legal and whatnot, yes, the resubmission is in, but we, like all banks, have, as I mentioned, a number of to-do items from the as a result of the last CCAR. The Federal Reserve expects further qualitative improvements out of all banks, so we are spending to address those further improvements in our stress testing processes. I do think the rate of spend on that will be less this year than last, and it should be less next year than this year.
And I just note that, I mean, this quarter last year it was $17.1 million, but it's actually down $5 million from where it was in this quarter last year, and that does reflect the fact that we're spending less on you know, CCAR-related improvements, but it's going to be there, you know, probably for a while as we continue to refine that process.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Yep.
Our next question comes from Ken Thurby with Morgan Stanley. Your line is open.
Hey, guys.
Okay.
I guess first question, just in terms of the small business demand, it seems that you guys have mentioned that small business demand has picked up or is picking up for, you know, the last several quarters. How much of the loan growth this quarter actually came from what you define as small businesses versus the larger businesses? And also, when you're looking into what you're seeing in July, sort of same question, what is being driven by small versus larger clients?
Well, we saw, Ken, this is James, a pickup in the line utilization rate, as mentioned in the press release, and although it's small, it was a pickup. The commitment rate for a large businesses actually declined. Our syndicated credit balances declined on a linked quarter basis, and then in terms of overall production volume, it was up for small business. In terms of balances, I'll have to get back to you after the call. I've got it in a sheet that's not with me here, the smallest and the $1 to $5 million size credits were the ones that definitely experienced some of the bigger increases in volume on the production side, and the optimism is definitely there. It's the approval rates on small business credits, for example, is probably up 10 to 15 percentage points compared to a couple of years ago, and we're now in the 75-80% approval rates of those that are applying. So that's a meaningful increase over the past couple of years.
And what that basically results from is that their balance sheets and income statements have kind of completed the healing process from the deep recession, and they've now built up 2 or 3 years of better financial performance that can be used to, you know, justify lending.
I also just a little footnote, and that is we were just named this last week as the recognized as the largest SBA lender in the Houston MSA, which is a first for us after, you know, working at that for several years. And for any of our people listening in, that big kudos for that. But I, you know, that puts us kind of in a leading position in SBA production in, you know, in Houston and in the state of Utah and up into Idaho, you know, a couple of the very best economies in the United States, where we're really doing a, I think, a really good job with SBA production, and that's kind of a bellwether for all kinds of other small business loans that we're doing in these markets.
Got it. Okay. And then a follow-up question, just in terms of the potential equity raise after you hear back from the Fed, are you guys in a position where you could actually execute on that equity raise as soon as you hear back, or just hoping to get an update on the timing of when that is likely to happen, and if you had also any thoughts on the form that that might happen in terms of either a dribble out or something else. Thanks.
Yeah, and I think we're just going to defer any discussion of the equity raise until there is one, if there is one, and that won't we won't be in a position to discuss that until after we have heard back from the Fed. We all want to avoid tripping over securities law issues about hyping a deal or anything like that. So let us duck that one, please.
Fair enough. All right. Thank you much.
Okay. Our next question comes from Jennifer Demba with SunTrust Robinson. Your line is open.
Jennifer?
Hi. Actually, Joe just took my question a second ago. I tried to queue out. But could you guys talk about I think you've talked in the last few quarters, you've talked about kind of bumping up against your concentration limits in certain categories, notably energy. Can you talk about where you are in that process right now?
Well, we have, under the limits we have in place, we still have some room. So we're not, you know, we're not ducking under the ceiling yet, but
we're pacing out the growth so that we can manage effectively concentrations and serve good customers.
Yeah.
Scott McLean here is here with us, so we'll let him.
Sure, Jennifer, this is Scott. And the concentration limits really are not constraining at the moment. There's a lot, as you know, there's a lot of churn in the oil field service business and in the reserve-based business in terms of private equity firms selling and repositioning their businesses. And so, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to be very active in both reserve-based midstream and oil field service while total outstandings, total commitments may stay relatively constant. There's a lot of opportunity to generate additional income.
Yeah, I think what I'd say is that, I mean, limits are, they're causing us to probably think twice about the kinds of, you know, so that we're not just growing willy-nilly, but there's still room for kind of prudent growth there, but it's, you know, it's something we watch.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Our next question comes from John Pancari with Evercore. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, guys.
Hi, John.
On the CCAR front, just a couple very quick questions there. I just want to see if you have any color on the Fed's extension request, which I'm assuming you may not, but figured I'd ask. And then also on the PPNR differential between, you know, where you're expecting than where you came out, wanted to see if you got any additional color from the Fed on that front. That's my main two things around CCAR.
Yeah. You know, I wish I could provide you color, but, you know, I think you've heard from us consistently and others that anything communications related to the whole stress testing and CCAR process, the Federal Reserve considers to be part of their supervisory process, and supervisory communication and information sharing is confidential. So I simply cannot provide you with any color. When we know something more definitive, it would be material, and we'll have to say something publicly at that time. But in terms of sharing information about the process of getting to that definitive answer, I simply can't.
All right, now that's fair. But you've mentioned your efforts to control your concentration risk, particularly as you're looking at commercial real estate. And as you're doing that, I know you've talked about some considerations, including potential securitizations, potential CDS. against your CRE underwriting. Can you talk to us, what developments have you completed on that front? How far along the path are you in terms of developing your own securitization capability? You know, how real is that opportunity?
We continue to explore a number of options, and there are some that are probably take longer to bring to fruition than others. Securitization probably falls into the that's going to take us a little longer. I mean, maybe a year or two to really build up the capability and also the pipeline of loans that have all of the standard characteristics that the CMBS type market is looking for. We continue to work on those, but we're also looking at nearer term ways to manage particular concentration risk, sell down some of our commitments or portfolio by offsetting portfolios of other types from other players, etc. So you may see more of that kind of activity in the nearer term, but over time, I think we remain convinced that what we have here is a very high quality commercial real estate origination capability, both for term loans and for construction and development loans. And we want to not only maintain but actually grow that capability over time in a very, very good market. But it's going to require developing on those capabilities more robustly to not keep all of that risk on our balance sheet under a stress testing environment. So did that kind of address your question?
Yes, it did. It did. And if I can ask just one more quick thing around expenses, Harris, I know you mentioned that you're still struggling with expenses here, or remains a challenge, as you put it. And in terms of your efficiency ratio, given your flattish expense expectations, is it fair to assume that the efficiency ratio is relatively stable here at this 74-75% level, or can we see it come down a bit here in the next couple quarters?
Well, some of the moving parts, provision for unfunded lending commitments, you have to take that out, I think, to really be fair about thinking about the ratio. Beyond that, we're working hard at some particular elements of non-interest income, which we know that we need to get to a little higher place. Our fee income mix looks like more like that of probably a typical $15 billion bank that does some of our larger peers, and some of those things will take a little time to address, but we're working really hard on several aspects of that we think over the next few years will really help. The big driver is going to be just a restoration of more traditional net interest margin levels as interest rates rise. That's going to make the big difference is getting back into a little more normal interest rate environment. That will really change the number. We're continuing to work at cost control. In the last couple of weeks, I've been in discussions about, probably up to roughly 10 to 12 locations that I would expect that will probably be closing in coming months or consolidating into other nearby branches, et cetera. So, we're working on that front. Doing what we can, but it's really a numerator or a denominator problem rather on the revenue side more than it is, I think, on the expense side in terms of what we can address. And we've got, we have some of these systems projects that are going to put some pressure on it for probably the next few quarters, especially until we can start to see some of the cost savings that come along with these projects.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Ken Usdin with Jefferies. Your line is open.
Thanks. Good afternoon. Doyle, I was wondering if you can give us an update on how you're thinking about those higher pieces of higher cost debt. You know, we've got the one coming due this year and then a couple of pieces next year. And so can you lay out for us whether at this point you just intend to just let those mature and whether or not just normal maturity would cause you to have to also, you know, reissue to, you know, to keep kind of flat on a funding cost basis?
Our current expectation, Ken, is that we will pay off that debt, the senior debt in September, and the additional two tranches of sub-debt in the latter half of next year as they mature, and that the total amount of unsecured debt issued by the parent would come down over that time period. We'll probably, we may issue small amounts of senior debt during that process, but the net amount of debt should come down. We're basically going to pay it off.
Okay.
No more tenders are expected. We don't think that would be very particularly productive.
Okay, that makes sense. And then secondly, just from a balance sheet asset side efficiency perspective to your earlier points about the need for keeping excess liquidity and then the uncertainties about deposit outflows. Can you talk about where you stand in terms of just waiting for loan growth versus reinvesting in the securities portfolio in terms of waiting for those final rules and maintaining an adequate buffer on the liquidity side?
I don't think we've changed our stance really from what we've been saying for a number of quarters now. There are no plans to buy significant amounts of longer-dated securities, particularly mortgage-backed securities. I'm not saying we won't do any, but no. The plan is to incrementally grow loans, we think that the deposit at the same time deposit growth will. Which has already slowed down and flattened, will likely continue to do so. And we've anecdotally heard of and seen instances of customers beginning to draw deposits down to redeploy cash internally within their businesses. So we're not planning to go out and invest a lot of that cash.
Okay, right. So just getting at this, so the governance of slowing the loan growth in pockets does not necessarily make you think about that any differently.
No, because we still expect net loan growth.
Right.
I think at this point we probably ought to allow one question each. We want to give, but defer the follow-ups to James to handle after the call, just so we can get. We got about five more people I think queued up, so we'll try to do bam, bam, bam.
Lightning round,
yes.
Our next question comes from Dave Rochester with Deutsche Bank. Your line is open.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Just to follow up on the cash position, I was just wondering how much excess cash you think you have at this point over what you might need for the LCR, and how long do you think it's going to take for loan growth to use up that excess, assuming that your assumptions play out there?
This is David Hemingway. First, as has been suggested, we do not have final rules for the LCR. So what I have to say is totally based upon our assumptions as to what the final rules might be. But we could have excess cash in the range, I would think, in the $2 to $3 billion range. And so you can actually do the math as how many quarters it would take to chew that up without any loan shrinkage. The big uncertainty is if and when, or when higher interest rates come, is the $19 billion of non-interest-bearing demand going to stay, or are the depositors going to act rationally and pull some of that money out? And those are the issues that we deal with in asset and liability management and liquidity management. So,
or how much of it converts into interest bearing?
Well, you know, how much of it converts into interest bearing? And if we need the money, we can probably keep it. But if we don't need the money, it'll probably go.
Yeah, there's no circumstance under which I would see deposit funding as constraining loan growth, because you can always go out and buy it. Okay, we'll move on to the next question.
Next question comes from Jeffrey Elliott with Autonomous Research. Your line is open.
Oh, hello there. So my question is on the deposit base, particularly the $19 billion of non-interest bearing. What is your latest thinking on how those deposits behave as rates increase, both the non-interest bearing and the interest bearing? And then how do you think the mechanism of Fed tightening impacts depositor behavior, whether it's raising reverse repo rate, raising interest on excess reserves, doing something else?
I would, Jeffrey, I'd refer you to the investor presentations that we've given in the second quarter. There are a couple of them out there, one of which at least was filed as an 8K, where we lay out pretty explicitly our thinking and the assumptions that underlie our IRR modeling. But basically, if you want to refer to somebody else who's in tune with our thinking, I'll refer you to the CFO of JPMorgan Chase, who laid out pretty explicitly what she thinks is going to happen. But I think we're directionally in the same place she is, which is that the Fed will drain a lot of liquidity out of the system, and that rates may rise. When rates rise, they may rise faster than people are expecting, and a lot of this, we've laid out some modeling assumptions about how much of our non-interest-bearing DDA would flow out and be replaced by interest-bearing funds. And I think we're being more conservative on that front than a lot of peers and more explicit in publishing what we're modeling, so I just refer you to that. As to the specific mechanisms the Fed might use and how much reliance on repos and other tools, I'm not. That's for them to decide, not for me to kibitz.
Thank you.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Brian Klock with Keefe, Bruyette & Woods. Your line is open.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hello, Brian.
Hey, I guess you mentioned earlier about the small business lending award in Houston, but I think, knowing that you guys are one of the biggest small business lenders in the country, and it sounds like there's been a lot of traction there, I guess, not just for you guys within the second quarter, but it still feels like that's something that's carrying into the third quarter. I'm kind of wondering why you're being a little bit more cautious for the loan growth outlook in the third versus a good second quarter, and is this anything to do with the 504 runoff? And I guess second part of that question is, can you update us on where the 504 national commercial real estate portfolio balances are quarter over quarter?
No, it's not. The caution wasn't related to any expected change in the rate of 504 runoff. That's kind of on its glide path that we've talked about. I guess it's probably more tempering just some of it's tempered by the CRE limits that we're kind of enforcing for the time being until we get another read on stress testing at least. And you have seen in the H8 data some pretty three out of the last 4 weeks have been down for the industry for lending, and we're despite the fact that pipelines remain pretty good and small business remains pretty good, we're hearing a little caution in other overall in other aspects of the portfolio. James, you want to add any other commentary on that?
Nope. I'll just fill in the blank on the change. The portfolio of national real estate loans, it's about a little over $3 billion, about $3.07 billion. It's divided in between term commercial real estate and owner occupied. It's about 60% owner occupied, 40% term commercial real estate. The linked quarter decline on that portfolio was about $150 million. So without that, our loan growth would have been a little bit, obviously about $150 million stronger.
Okay, and just this is going to probably stabilize at $2 billion? Is that what your guidance has been for the glide path?
Current production levels will put it at about $1.5 billion.
About one and a
but,
half.
But right. We are starting to hear some green shoots. It sounded, as I discussed it with the people in that group, it sounded like the green shoots of loan growth and credit quality back in 2009. You may have one or two blades of grass, I think, would be the description. But we're starting to hear some inquiries from community banks looking. They're starting to bump up against their liquidity ratio issues and are looking towards National Real Estate Group as a source for that.
Okay. Thanks for your time, guys.
Yep.
Okay. Next question comes from Kevin Barker with Compass Point. Your line is open.
Given that you've gone through all the CCAR process and it's been a back and forth and you've a high level of compliance, have you ever considered, rather than raising equity capital, looking to spin off a bank that where you can get a higher valuation than where the stock is trading now? And that would also, you know, lower your asset size below $50 billion so you wouldn't have to deal with CCAR on a go-forward basis. Have you ever considered something like that rather than raising equity?
Let me, I've been asked this question a number of times, and Harris might as well. I mean, spinning off a bank, even if we were to contemplate it, probably doesn't get you where you're suggesting we might want to try to be. If you got down to $40, $45 billion, then normal growth is going to take you back to the $50 billion mark, which is cast in law currently, within a fairly short period of time. And the last thing you're going to do is blow up the capabilities that were built at great cost and great pain. Even assuming the Fed would say, yes, you've escaped, you're off the hook, I think even that point is debatable. I think you'd have taking that path is highly, highly uncertain to achieve the outcome you're suggesting.
Okay. Thank you for taking my question.
Okay.
I think that's the end of the questions that we have, and the end, we're over time at this point anyway. We thank you for participating in the call today, and if you have follow-up questions, please email me. This is James Abbott, and I'll be happy to respond. And thank you for your time, and we'll see you very soon at a conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's program. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect.